Thank you, Efrain. Thank you all for coming out tonight. Beyond Megachurch Myth was written with the intent to straddle between research-oriented analysis of the megachurch phenomena and a practical leadership guide for clergy who wanted to learn from these highly successful megachurches. This is the reason my co-author, Dave Travis, of the Leadership Network, which is a church networking organization for innovative congregations, and I teamed up to write this book. He kept me from waxing theoretical and impractical, and I kept him firmly grounded in what the data said. As such, this talk is going to be both about the book and about megachurches, and hopefully it will be informative and also perhaps a little practical. So what is a megachurch? Well, as you can see, a megachurch is a Protestant Christian congregation with a sustained average weekly attendance of 2,000 persons or more in worship. There's roughly about 1,250 megachurches in the United States, and that's about 0.5% of all the congregations in the country. The megachurches are often thought of as a new phenomenon, but it really isn't that new. There have been very large congregations in existence since the time of Constantine, with several churches in the mega range evident in most periods of American religious history. One of the more famous, Angeles Temple, seated 5,500 and was back in the 1930s. Another Chicago Avenue church was D.L. Moody's church, and it was said that that church seated 10,000. But, and just to let you know that indeed inside it even looked like a megachurch. That's the inside of the church. But since the 1960s, a number of these large churches has increased at a dramatic rate. As you can see from the slide, the numbers have dramatically risen in the last two decades. Looked at another way, in 1970, there was approximately one megachurch for every 4 million people in the country. By 1990, it was one megachurch per million. And in 2005, there were 4 megachurches per million people in the U.S. The notoriety and influence of these churches and their pastors has even outpaced this phenomenon's rapid proliferation. We posit in the book that in many ways, the leaders of these congregations have become, for good or ill, the religious spokespersons for our society. In 2005, several megachurch pastors had books on the New York Times bestsellers list. One of the books has over 26 million sales to date. If you couldn't guess. And has been translated into 309 languages. Another megachurch pastor and first-time author had over 3 million sales in a single year. That's probably a little bit more than this book will have. This pastor of the largest megachurch in the country, Joel Osteen of Lakewood Church in Houston, will reportedly be given $13 million in signing for his second book. Megachurch pastors have always dominated the most influential religious leaders list, at least in the last few decades. These pastors are the voices in newspaper articles, and their churches are the on-location spots for TV crews covering religion. Nearly every list that comes out of influential pastors have these folks on. Likewise, if you think about the informal networks of churches and pastors that are connected with these congregations, they rival most of the established denominations. So whether you're aware of these happenings or not, these large churches cannot be avoided. They are now scattered throughout the country, including a few in the spiritual hinterlands of New England. New England accounts for about 5% of all the megachurches. This notoriety with this phenomenon has created two realities. Nearly everyone, and by that I mean reporters, clergy, politicians, seminarians, pay attention to them. But until recently, almost no scholarly research gave them a second thought. Thus, much of what we find in newspapers, hear discussed on talk radio, and have the misfortune to read in countless blogs are perceptions that are based on a few biased experiences rather than on systematic national data. This is why we wrote the book. We grew tired of caricatures of megachurches and their pastors, listening to descriptions of them that fit at most 20% of the total, drawn from someone's casual encounter with a church's pastor or a solitary visit to a church. These descriptions didn't match our years of interaction with these churches and pastors, nor did they match with the two national studies that I did in 2000 and 2005. So we hoped that Beyond Megachurch Myths would set the record straight, once and for all, and at least offer a reasoned and data-driven portrayal of these churches to counter some of these misperceptions. What's blatantly obvious is that these congregations are doing something which attracts people. Over 5 million attenders each week go to megachurches, with perhaps as many as 10 to 15 million more marginally involved in these congregations. And these churches have a collective annual income of over $7 billion. And they're this appealing at a time when the news about American religious organization looks pretty bleak. So this evening, I'd like to address a few of these stereotypes that we identify in the book and show how our findings shed a different light on the topic. There's some truth in each of these myths. After all, that's how the images and the myths evolved in the first place. And it's clear that some of these churches really do fit the stereotypes. We've gotten criticisms already. Well, I know this church fits the stereotype, and that is the case in some ways. But by and large, none of the stereotypes that's presented fully represent and encompass the phenomena as a whole. So what are the myths that we discuss? These are the 9 myths that we talk about in the book. I don't want to go through each one of them this evening, but I do want to touch on a few of them and show what data we have that contradicts some of the myths. But before I do that, let me say, throughout the book, we continue to make the assertion that there is no one type of megachurch. That really, in fact, there are at least 4 distinctively different types of megachurch based on leadership and structure and polity. While all of the megachurches do have some common characteristics, you have to continue to remember that they're not all the same. One of the things that we do in the book is we try to identify some of these groupings of megachurches, and we break them down into 4 distinctively different groups. These groups we call old-line program-based, and they account for about 30% of megachurches. And then there are the seeker-sensitive churches, like Willow Creek, that account for about another 30% of megachurches. And then we characterize another as pastor-focused or charismatic megachurches, and those account for about 25% of all megachurches. And then finally, probably the most growing segment of megachurches are what we describe as new wave or re-envisioned. Sometimes they're seen also as emerging and other names as well. And they account for the final 15%. I don't want to delve too deeply into these distinctions, but as we proceed, keep in mind that these variations do occur within this species. We have a long list of characteristics in the book, and so if you're interested in reading more about that, go ahead and buy a copy and have at it. But now, on to the first myth for tonight. And this is probably the most spoken myth, at least to me, and that is that these megachurches are nothing but cults of someone's personality. Now, when you begin to think about that, in nearly all congregations, the pastor is leader, at least the spiritual leader. And as a church grows and gets larger in size, so does the standing and the status of that senior pastor. And once a congregation reaches a large size, oftentimes the megachurches attempt to brand that pastor, to market the personality who's in the pulpit as if that symbolizes, that's the totem for the whole church. So most people, when I say Lakewood, they understand Joel Osteen's church or Rick Warren's church. That sometimes is intentional in some of these congregations, especially the ones that are on television. And also for those who are very pastor-focused, it is somewhat true. I think it's also important to see that as these congregations begin to grow and get larger and larger, there's a distance created between the congregation as a whole and the senior pastor. There has to be some distancing. There has to be some division of labor. There has to be some delegation of authority. So the senior minister is no longer seen as the person who's doing all the pastoral care. And what that does is begin to create more and more distance between the senior pastor and the congregation. Not only that, the senior pastor takes on a more symbolic role as the spiritual leader of the community. They're the vision cast there. They're not doing the daily pastoral care. They're not going to all the visits in the hospital. Instead, they have a different role to play as the organization gets larger. So, in fact, not only is it reshaping how they interact with the congregation, but the size of these organizations also reshape how they're seen. When you have a congregation that seats 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people, in order to see the senior minister, they're projected on a large screen. They end up becoming larger than life to the congregation. Not only that, the 30% that do television, those folks who are watching their pastor on television, he becomes a celebrity to them. All of these factors enhance, in a sense, the personality of the senior minister in a way that most congregations don't have to wrestle with, and most megachurch pastors do. But it's not by any means intentional, oftentimes, in the congregation or in the minds of the senior minister that I'm going to be a celebrity. Not only that, when we surveyed the members, almost none of them mentioned the pastor as the reason why they came or the reason why they stay. There are other dynamics there that are at work that are much more powerful than just the charisma and the interaction of the senior pastor. So to the next myth. This too is one that I hear quite often. Megachurches water down the faith, that somehow they're preaching Christianity light. Now, it's absolutely clear that if you turn on the television, you're going to hear megachurch pastors preach some pretty fluffy sermons. But remember, only about 30% of megachurch pastors are on television. And if you go to a worship service at a megachurch, especially the seeker worship megachurches, you're going to hear some user-friendly gospel, and it's going to be enacted by a drama team, and they might have antics on stage, like motorcycles jumping over the senior pastor, or an elephant come out. One megachurch pastor even drove a tank across the stage. All of those things are supplemental to the worship service. Likewise, if you read a few of those megachurch pastors' books, you too can have your best life now and get all the self-help you need. But if you just judge megachurches by those characteristics, perhaps they are watering down the faith. But in fact, my encounters with megachurches and our research shows that there's much more going on in megachurches than just TV and just Sunday seeker services and just the self-help books. Nearly every megachurch pastor and church we looked at adheres to an orthodox understanding of the Christian faith and also emphasizes the practices of a Christian church just as much as smaller congregations in the country. We have data on the slide that shows when attenders were asked if their spiritual needs are being met, the answers were quite high. Nearly almost 90% agreed or strongly agreed that their spiritual needs were being met. Likewise, when you look at what the congregations are doing compared to the faith communities today data of congregations of all sizes across the country, the megachurch data is not deficient in what it's doing. Again, if you continue to look and see the comparison of the megachurches to this larger national set of data for all sizes of congregations, there are places where the megachurches are clearly not measuring up to smaller congregations, but there are also plenty of places, especially around support groups, around evangelism, and certainly around fundraising activities, that are much higher than smaller congregations. But with that said, it doesn't show a deficiency in theology or a deficiency in the programming of megachurches that they're somehow Christianity light. Megachurches approach unbelievers in a way that's distinctively different than most traditional congregations. The megachurch intentionally casts its net wide in a community. It brings in both saints and sinners all together. Sunday is a spectator service for some, but at the same time, what megachurches are trying to do is to bring all the people, both the saved and the unsaved, together, and then use the worship service, use the life of the congregation as a way to move people from being an unbeliever to being a mature Christian. So the megachurches intentionally strive to move their marginal spectators who come infrequently for the tanks and for the motorcycle jumps, to move them from being just occasional attenders to regular attenders, to committed participants. And they do this by using intentional strategies of discipleship. Now, there are a number of different strategies for different churches. What I have on this slide are two different understandings of how to move someone from being a new Christian or an inquiring person to move them along to be a committed person in the church. But clearly for megachurches, the nurturance and the nurturance and maturity in the Christian faith isn't a one-day-a-week enterprise. You don't just come in on Sunday and get your helping of theology and good Christianity and then go home and live it out throughout the week. In a megachurch, what you have to see is what is happening the entire week, what is happening the entire month, and that is all reinforcing what it means to be a Christian there. So what happens in small groups? What happens in ministry activities? What happens in the bike groups and in softball? What happens when you're praying with your fellow parking lot attendants? All of that is part and parcel of what it means to becoming a mature Christian in a megachurch. And here, small groups are key, not just for the spiritual maturation process, but also to create intimacy and solidify relationships that then in turn increase commitment to the church and to each other. When we look at the structure of small groups in the megachurches, we find that a vast majority of them not only use small groups, 50% say that small groups are central to their strategy of Christian nurturance. But not only that, they also take the people who are still brand new at the church and immediately try to integrate them into the life of the congregation. 96% of congregations strongly encourage new members to volunteer in church ministries. 88% invite new members to participate in small groups. They're not taking someone and saying, okay, you have to be saved, you have to go through some sort of classes, you have to demonstrate that you're saved by living a perfect life, and then you can volunteer and act in our ministries. Instead, they take them off the street and say, come work with us, come participate with us, come get engaged with us. And it's through that interaction with people who are already involved in ministry that these people then say, well, you know, there's something going on here. I want to be a part of this. It's a different way of trying to bring people into the faith. When members were asked, fully 70% said that they were involved in some form of small group in the life of the church. Now, another myth that I hear often. These churches are full of people of the same race, the same class, and the same political preference. They're all the same. They're all middle class, suburbanite, highly mobile, and have a distinctive sort of cultural lifestyle. Well, in fact, that is in part true. There is truth to this myth. But there's also, in megachurches and congregations of this size, a significant amount of diversity in this group. There are pockets of folks who don't look like the rest of the people. And those pockets can sometimes amount to 20, 30, 40%. And that's true whether you're talking about race, whether you're talking about income, whether you're talking about educational level, and even, surprising to many people, whether you're talking about what political party you're a part of or what social causes you support. What really, in part, pulled me into the study of megachurches was when I was studying an ex-gay ministry of one of the megachurches, and I found sitting in the same pew with me at the church several gay guys who would never go to the ex-gay ministry, and yet they loved going to the church. Even though the pastor said, you know, homosexuality isn't okay, they loved the worship, they loved the preaching, and they felt perfectly comfortable to be in that congregation along with all the other folks who were trying to leave the lifestyle. There's something about these large congregations that can tolerate a lot of diversity. And this is nowhere clearer than the question of multiracial and multi-ethnic worship. In the U.S., roughly 7% of U.S. congregations are multiracial, meaning that they have no more than 80% of one racial group. And for Catholic congregations, it rises to about 15%, and for Protestants, it falls to about 5%, have 20% folks not in the majority race. But in our research on megachurches, what we found was that 35% of megachurches claim to have 20% or more minority presence. And when we asked them if they were doing anything to promote being a multi-ethnic congregation, almost 60% said they were intentionally trying to restructure their worship service, trying to restructure their leadership to be more multiracial and multi-ethnic. This is such a distinctive thing that Robert Putnam, the Harvard professor of public policy, recently wrote that many large evangelical congregations constitute the largest thoroughly integrated gatherings he had ever witnessed. There's something about these large congregations that does make this holding together of diversity possible. So another myth. The megachurch movement is dying. And they say that because young people, of course, hate these congregations. Now, this idea is based on the assumption that the megachurch phenomena is rooted in the baby boom. And so the megachurch form is shaped around the values and the ideals of the baby boom. So the generations afterwards don't have any resonance with it any longer, and therefore it's going to drift away eventually as the baby boom ages and dies. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true, and we can talk about that in the question and answer period, but that's where it's based. However, it's clearly not based in reality. It's not based in the data. If you walk into a megachurch, what you are going to find is nearly 50% of the people are under 45. And in many megachurches, it's even higher than that. Our data showed that 47% of megachurches had between 40 and 80% of adults under 35. Another 46% had 20 to 40% of adults under 35. Perhaps. I have to apologize. The measurement of that is not a good way to try to report it. I think one of the things that needs to be seen, because clearly you hear when you talk to some of the younger generations, especially those who are in the emerging church movement and small house fellowship movements, they're tired of large-scale organizations, and megachurches are, you know, the whipping boy for everything that's wrong with American Christianity for them. I think we have to realize that in fact, religion in the United States is very much a subcultural group-specific reality. And so for some folks in certain subgroups, the megachurches are not going to appeal to them. That's why I said these congregations, as many as there are and as much influence as they have, are still only half of 1% of all the congregations. There are plenty of other types of congregations out there to appeal to different people. It's true both for young people, but it's also true for adults. There's only two kinds of people in the country: the people that think megachurches are heaven on earth, and those that think they're something else on earth. and would never, ever go back once they've gone. You either love them or you hate them for the most part. Now, those are some of the myths that we cover. There are many more in the book, and we obviously argue it much better than I've presented it here today. But I want to move to talk a little bit about the idea that megachurches are different from traditional churches in more ways than just size. Clearly, they are different in terms of size. But as I said before, they're also different in approach. They're different in the way they do evangelism, the way they bring people into the life of the church. In nearly every megachurch I've been in, there's a willingness to include the unsaved in their midst, to open up the service and to make it user-friendly, to not stay with the same old routines and traditions, but instead to try new things, to experiment, to risk failing, and then picking oneself up and trying it again. This, in turn, encourages members not to just go out into the community and convert people and bring them in, but instead to open up the service to be the place of conversion. The service is the place. The life of the church is where people are converted. So it makes the members not feel like they have to go out and witness to their friends, but instead they can bring them to church with them, knowing full well that interaction with the congregation is going to change them. Not only that, megachurches are relevant. By that I mean they've gone out of their way to translate the gospel into everyday language, into everyday idioms, into a style that resonates with contemporary culture. They use examples that are drawn on daily experiences. On their big screens, they show movie clips, commercials. The music you listen to is the same music that you could hear in your car on the way driving in. They blur the distinction, in a sense, between the secular and the sacred. So it makes it easier for secular people to come into the audience. But it also makes it easier for people to take home the sacred and pass through that boundary in a way without having to leave the sacred in the sacred space. Not only that, they're contemporary. Now, it's absolutely clear that megachurches use electric guitars, projection screens, high tech, All those things congruent with modern life, far more than smaller congregations. And this is in part because they have the technological skills and the resources, but it's also because they've adopted a different way of interacting. They want to be congruent with culture. They want to be relevant. Not only that, megachurches are about quality, they're about choice, but probably more importantly, those things are connected to how they respond to their clientele. Megachurches have adopted, in some ways, a market attitude. They're willing to allow consumers to pick and choose what fits them and fits their spiritual needs. But they're not content just to leave them as marginally committed, satisfied, because our needs are being met. Instead, they create these intentional structures to pressure and mature people in the faith. And they do this through the strategic use of small groups and lay ministry. They don't rely on professional clergy to do all of the ministry at the church. The distinctives that are evident in megachurches once they become large were there in part or in full measure when these churches started out. We're convinced that many of the factors that contribute to the megachurch's success once it's large are the same dynamics that create the growth in the first place. These churches and pastors have a vision, a sense that God is calling them together to do something specific in the world. They convey that in a way that excites their attenders, that excites their members, makes them want to go out and bring people into the church. They want to share the experiences. And this is so distinctive. When we asked these congregations, compared to all of the other congregations that were in the Faith Communities Today project, to what extent is your congregational members involved in recruiting new people to come into the church? You can see the distinctive differences between the megachurches, where almost 50% say their members are involved a lot, compared to the smaller congregations in the FACT project, where only 15% say their members are involved a lot. So once the members bring these people in, because they're excited about bringing these people in, and they get quality things when they come in, they're not just there to be entertained. They're not just there for the tanks and for the cars jumping and such. They're also constantly reminded, they're constantly provoked, they're constantly encouraged to get intentionally incorporated into the life of the church. They're asked to do things. They're asked to be involved. They're asked to work alongside the core committed members. And in that process, then they too become core and committed. So, what is the future of megachurches? Well, it's clear from our research that megachurches will be around for quite some time, at least as long as society wants its organizations supersized. Megachurches have been shaped by societal and cultural influences to become what they are today. But they're also beginning to act back upon both secular society in interesting ways, and also they're having a profound effect on the religious life around the globe. There's no doubt that these large congregations have infused a casual informality and expressivism into Christian worship. In part, they've also helped to detach the sacred from centuries of established routines and rituals in worship life. These largest congregations also are continuing the process of disconnecting American religious life from control by national denominations. In so doing, megachurches are reworking religious organizational forms in very interesting ways. They are introducing loosely affiliated networks of churches that, as I said before, easily can compete with national denominations in their size. They're also creating decentralized centers of non-denominational resources, whether they be literature, books, materials for all kinds of services, music, all of those things are becoming also disconnected from the life of denominations. Not only that, these megachurches are experimenting with unique and unusual organizational forms like multiple venue worship, so that one can go as if you're going into a movie theater and choose what type of worship you would like to have that day. Do I want traditional worship with a piano or with an organ? Or would I like some contemporary with electric guitars? Or maybe I'm really into grunge today and I just want to hear some heavy metal or some darker, louder music. So I choose what experience I want to have of the worship form, but then when it comes time for the sermon, we all get the same solid teaching from the senior minister, piped in by either satellite or cable. Not only that, they've taken it out of the local area and have created branch campuses of the same church that are often connected by satellites and a virtual preacher. So there's one congregation in Oklahoma that has satellite campuses in three different states, including Florida. And yet only one senior pastor, one message to all of these congregations, one budget, one organization. Radical changes to the way we think of American religious organizations. Not only that, this same church that I just mentioned has a virtual campus that every Sunday at 9 and 11, people tune in and have worship together. And then they go to the chat room and have coffee afterwards. This church has actually a physical presence of this virtual campus. They have a real pastor assigned to the internet church. They have a worship team that plays music just for that online reality. This is radical revision of the organizational form we think of as church. More importantly, I think, than even these congregations have either consciously or unknowingly embraced a merchant mentality toward the spiritual consumer in American culture. They allow the individual to choose his or her involvement, to tailor their experiences of the divine to meet their own needs. Rather than asking persons to accept salvation, convert, and then enter into the communion of the saints, megachurches bring both saint and sinner to the banquet table, let them enjoy the spiritual sustenance, encourage them to become involved, insist that they become involved, and through all of this, then, they begin to grow in grace and they begin to understand what it means to be truly a mature Christian. Congregations of all sizes, as well as secular service organizations and businesses, have much to learn from the corporate success of megachurches. Indeed, they are, as Robert Putnam suggests, the most interesting social invention of the late 20th century. However, learning from them can only come when we look at the phenomena with the bright light of quality data, rather than a dim bulb of stereotypes and misperceptions. My co-author and I hope that we've provided some of that light by which to better see this interesting and under-examined religious phenomena. Thank you. I'm more than happy to take some questions or to chat some, but you have to come to the mic, I understand.
Scott, in your research, have you found any differences in the mega churches in the way that they utilize the sacraments of baptism and the Eucharist from the more traditional small churches?
Yes. Next question. Well, I know the liturgically minded among us are going to, like, cringe. when I begin to describe how, you know, you can walk into the megachurch and you get a little vacuum-sealed bit of grape juice with a little bit of the host all together, sort of the way you would, you know, picking up your lunch going into because, well, I think there's two things that are really crucial in thinking about this question. One is nearly all of the megachurches are evangelical, conservative congregations, whether they're in mainline denominations or in evangelical denominations. And I think compared to a high liturgical tradition, Lutheran, Episcopalian, Catholic, there's definitely less sacramental Eucharistic worship. So that you see a decline for sure, just when you move from mainline liberal congregations to conservative evangelical. But then also, as the size gets larger, it increases the complexity of doing some of these things. So many of the megachurches will find other ways of doing communion, for instance. Oftentimes, some will have it be optional for the person, and so they will have tables set around the room, and some people can pray, and others can go to the table and take communion. Or, as I said, everyone can pick up their little container, and at a certain point in the church service, they would have the Lord's Supper. In terms of baptism, it also is a challenge, and oftentimes it's done with, again, less pomp, less ritual. I've been in mega churches where, when they're doing, where they're taking offering or singing, the baptisms are happening at the same time. I've also been in mega churches where it becomes essentially a Sunday afternoon party, and you know, everyone who is connected with the people who are baptizing come back at 1 o'clock, and they spend 1 to 4 baptizing people and singing. And it's a much more kind of communal and significant, I think, event. So different churches do it differently, but size really does complexify that immensely.
In your research, have you been able to discover why megachurches seem to be growing incredibly in number in the South versus the North? For example, in the New England area, I believe you only have 2, versus if you go down to Jacksonville, Florida, there are 5 on the same street.
Yes. Yeah, they do have a tendency to cluster around the things. You know, it's like the auto parts store across the corner from each other. The megachurch is the same way. I think there are a number of different answers to that question. Early on in the megachurch phenomena, it was absolutely clear that it was a southern, Sun Belt phenomena, suburban phenomena. And I think in part it's due to the fact that there were always relatively large Southern Baptist churches in some of the major cities, you know, First Baptist in pretty much every city in the South. So there was an acceptance of large scale worship already in place. Not only that, there is a higher percentage of religiosity in the South in many ways, but also the megachurches thrive in suburban sprawl, and that tended to be in the Sun Belt for a very long time. So you have demographics, you have the influence of religion. You have a precedent already established, that all of which I think contributed to seeing more megachurches in the Sun Belt all the way across. But what you see now is completely different, because many of our cities in the North, in the Midwest, in the Northwest are developing into suburban realities. And so what once was a few megachurches in New England Well, now you can begin to see suburban life taking place in Simsbury or down on the Gold Coast of Connecticut. And what you begin to see are more and more congregations at the 1,000, 1,500 attender level. And so I expect even in New England within the next 5 or 10 years to probably be another 10, 20 megachurches appear. Some are very close to that right now. You also see much more of an acceptance of the form. You know, when you watch on television, you see all these images. Then more people in small towns, more people in areas where there weren't any megachurches are beginning to be exposed to the idea that, you know, it's a legitimate religious form. And so then they're more open to be willing to have megachurches down the street, basically. Would you like a job? I know a couple megachurches. We have a retired megachurch pastor among us. We cover this topic quite a bit in the book because it's an issue, I think, that's quite fascinating to me, but it's also one that in our final chapter where we talk about what's on the horizon for megachurches, this is clearly the elephant in the room kind of thing. Approximately 30% of the megachurches that exist now have already gone through pastoral changes. Some of those have gone through several changes of pastors from the pastor who initially created the tremendous growth. When we separate those churches from the other congregations in our sample and look at them on measures of vitality, on measures of growth, on measures of happiness by the attenders, it is absolutely clear that those who have gone through pastoral change do not measure up with those who still have their pastor of growth. There are clear differences in terms of how much conflict, in terms of how much vitality and optimism, all sorts of. So I would not want to be a person who replaces the megachurch pastor who grew the church. But with that being said, at the same time, we don't see all of the stories of doom and gloom that people predict, you know, that if this cult of personality is going to crumble because Jerry Falwell died or you know, because a pastor had sexual misconduct and was removed or something. The congregations have a tremendous amount of momentum. They have a lot of inertia, and I often think they're like a giant rock rolling down a hill. A big chunk of that rock can fall off, and the rock is going to continue rolling. There are always people to step up and take over the pulpit. Yeah, 3,000 people? Yeah, I'll lead you. No problem. And for a long time, megachurch, that's how megachurches operated. They figured, well, if our pastor dies or retires or whatever, somebody else will fill in and we'll just continue on. Now, a lot of the congregations, especially the youngest congregations, are strategically planning for their senior leader to leave. And so, in fact, a congregation that's only 5 years old, that's already reached 3,000 in attendance, is already have a strategy in place if that senior pastor leaves or dies or moves on. It's quite fascinating to see how forward-thinking, especially the youngest ones, are. And I have to say, when we look at the newest megachurches, those that have been founded as churches in the last 10 years, those congregations are growing the fastest of any of the congregations, not surprisingly, but they're also growing to the largest sizes and have the greatest levels of vitality, of member participation in the life of the church and in recruitment. It is quite amazing. So when you think about the future of megachurches, these newest, youngest congregations are really quite incredible. They're and many of them are the sons of megachurch pastors or past associate pastors from a megachurch that have launched out, and they grow just instantaneously almost. It's quite amazing. I'm not sure if I'll get all the nuances of that question, but I agree with you. I think there is a shift in the nature of church in many ways, and some of it comes out in how people are brought to the church and nurtured in the faith and that sort of thing. But also I think part of it has to do with the nature of megachurch not thinking of are gathering together as one large group, one communion, being the church. I mean that in a sense the church is stretched out over time. I mean I'm in charge of distance ed, and I think about it sometimes. The difference between a face-to-face course where everybody comes together on Wednesday and we get our teaching and then we go home and wait till next Wednesday, but we're part of the class all the way through. But this is when we're together. As opposed to a distance ed, an online course, where in fact the class happens throughout the whole week, and then a new subject comes along and the class happens again. I think the life of the church in a megachurch is that extended. It's a 24/7 sort of thing. So the gathering together at several different times, several different places, different venues, different satellites, all of that sort of thing, that is in part to recognize that we are one body, that we are together here, we're worshiping. And when you get two or three or five or 10,000 together, it's quite an energetic amount of worship. But if it's just that, if it's just I'm coming on Sunday to hear the great music and to participate and to be part of a successful enterprise, then that's inadequate. And nearly every megachurch pastor I talk to agrees. They don't want that kind of participation. What substitutes for the anonymity and the large mass scale of that kind of worship are these small groups, these networks, these honeycombs, connections that people have, not just in the small groups around Bible studies or the small groups around ministries, but all the different life of small groups that are intentionally created outside of the worship service. That's what I mean by, in a sense, there are many touch points by which the message, the vision, the understanding of the church as a whole group get played out. And that is a different understanding of church in many ways. And I think it's still trying to be understood, and still trying to be understood by megachurch pastors. They're trying different models all the time. Does that make sense?
There's been a lot of talk recently in the media about the influence of the so-called, what they're calling the Christian Reconstruction Movement, the people who definitely said quite avowedly that they want to make this a Christian nation based on biblical law in the most literal sense. And I was wondering if you've seen much influence of that in the megachurches, because I know that they're sort of being targeted with that Russian stuff.
Well, I'll go back to my one statement at the beginning of the talk, that there are lots of different kinds of megachurches. But you know, in fact, there are the vast majority of congregations that fall into the kind of Christian Reconstructionist model really tend toward a sort of fundamentalist viewpoint. And in fact, most megachurches are not fundamentalist. Even though they're all evangelical, they are really open to culture. They're really open to society, and as such, they're less likely, I think, to adopt some of the Christian Reconstructionist viewpoints. With that being said, I could name half a dozen or more. Probably they wouldn't agree, but I think that have been greatly influenced by some of the ideas of kingdom theology and taking dominion over society and some of those ideas, not in their pure form as some of the leaders of the Christian Reconstructionist movement have painted them, but in a much more watered down way. At the same time, too, and this brings up politics in some ways, I think nearly all the evangelical involvement in politics in the last 15, 20 years really has, at its very root, some of the ideas of the Christian Reconstructionist movement. I know I'm not alone there, but there's other people who think something different. But I see that some of the Christian Coalition and Jerry Falwell's efforts very much fueled by some of the ideas of the Christian Reconstructionists. And those ideas are also present in the megachurch, in their relationship to politics and involvement in local elections and things like that. The question is, no.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out how I'm going to see it. Any idea how long or what type of turnover there is in the congregation? How long someone is in one of these? Is there a constant?
Sure, good question. I planted you because it leads me into saying that, in fact, I'm going to be on sabbatical, praise the Lord, January through June of next year, and we are intending not just another large national study of key informants of megachurches, but we're also going to look very closely at about 14 megachurches and survey the attenders, because there is a void of information about why people are attracted, why they stay, when they leave, how. So there's really very, very little data. The bit of data that exists and my experiences say that there are, and I could draw my little picture there, I think of the people who go to a megachurch as a pyramid. And the people you see on Sunday morning as an iceberg, and what you see in the 2,000 or 4,000 people who are attending is really just the tip of all of the people who are involved in that church. What you see are the core people and the committed people and the moderately engaged people, and usually about a third of the marginal people, people who are visitors, people who come once a month, people who call it their church but only show up, you know, once every quarter. But if you think about that pretty much third to almost a half sometimes, it is those marginal people, those folks that they're trying to witness to, the people that they're trying to bring into the fold. You know, it's the recruits in a sense. If they come once a month, which some of the data shows that there's a big chunk that only come once a month, that means there's an equally, I mean, even larger chunk of folks that are there also to cycle through. So that's the snapshot picture on any given month, any given week. But then at the same time, that large group of people also cycles through. There's a revolving front door in megachurches, and there's also a revolving back door. And for folks, they come in, they experience it, they haven't been saved, you know, they're not involved in it, and then they drift away. Other people come for various other reasons and find that it doesn't suit their needs, and then they move on. And not only that, megachurches really do appeal often, and in part because of the suburban Sun Belt phenomena, to people who are transient, people who have been moved to Atlanta for a job, and now they're moved to Denver, and then they're going to be moved to San Diego. Well, a megachurch and its forms and structures are perfect for those folks. They can come in, they can get involved in small groups, they can get involved in ministry, they can learn to connect with the people in the community, and then they can go on. They can go to another megachurch in a different city. So there's a lot of that also taking place. So it's pretty fluid in a lot of people. In the really committed folks, I think you find people who have been at megachurches for 10, 20, 30 years, don't see themselves going anywhere else. That, I really want to test that, but from the indications of the data, that I think is absolutely the case. And they know it, you know, before they even go, you know, pastor told me I really should come here. And so it's very true. Yes.
Do you know how many of these megachurches are headed by women in the past? And I suspect not many, unless this is all for men. And what does this say about the megachurches that they are women in the past?
Yeah, no, that's not one of those myth ones. we can count on one hand how many are led by women. I think it is five, and it out of 1,250, and that varies even by saying, are they clergy couples, or did this couple, a husband died, or moved out of ministry, and the wife, and then it probably gets down to even maybe two or three. That are seriously led by a woman senior pastor. What does it say? I mean, I think it has to be seen in part in the context of conservative evangelical Christianity. They are less likely to have women pastors in Southern Baptist, in the Assemblies of God, in Missouri Synod Lutherans, many of those. So it's probably, you know, you wouldn't expect a lot of women pastors of megachurches. At the same time, you know, I think it says that there's a lot more room for some openness there. But women are in leadership roles in megachurches quite a bit, in a lot of typical ways, they are empowered in, I mean, if you think about compared to a smaller congregation, there are women heads of drama teams or of the Christian ed, but what they're in charge of is a massive enterprise. You know, being in charge of the Christian education program at a megachurch means you're working with 1,500 youth, and you're working with 40 teachers. It's you know, not ideal, but it is the reality. And when you broaden it to the mainline, we just took a look at this. When you broaden it to the mainline, it's even the case that there are very few mainline and liberal congregations that are very large, that are led by women. And in fact, the largest one was a metropolitan community church. It's a gay-oriented denomination that now has joined with the United Church of Christ. That's the largest sort of liberal mainline church. So the mainline's not faring much better when it comes to very big churches. I've been signaled that time is just about up. Time is up. Maybe one more question? One more question. Yes, Dr. Dudley.
Scott, terrific presentation.
Thank you.
You've spent most evening on particular congregations. Can you say something about the networking and support? When you talk about congregations being honeycombs of support, how do they get support? They obviously don't need denominations. They do their own thing. And in what way does that networking among these reflect your four groups? Does it all, or are they kind of cross those, or, you know, you don't have denominational ties? How do they figure out how those networks function? And what does it say about denominations and the way in which they function? And what does it say about theological education and the way in which we prepare leadership?
Well, I'm sorry, I think the tape just ran out. Okay, at least a few pieces of that. It's clear that in many ways the megachurch, individual megachurches, are functioning as kind of mini denominations, that they gather around them congregations, people, and it functions as we can do more interconnected, or we can share resources in an interconnected way that parallels the typical denominational idea. Beneath, in some sense, a megachurch, there is a mini network denomination. Between the megachurches, there is a good bit of cooperation, and I have seen that increasing in the last two decades of my own observations of megachurches. Now they are much more likely to play well with each other than they were, I think, 20 years ago. And in part, it's because of groups like the Leadership Network, who is there just to put together the leaders of these congregations, knowing full well that, and one of the things I didn't say, that the vast majority of megachurches are denominational. They have some denominational affiliation. No more than about 30% are truly non-denominational. But when you get this large, even the denominational ones can keep the denomination at arm's length. But groups like the Leadership Network have put these people together, and so consequently they're sharing resources, they're learning from each other in ways that I think they hadn't before. Now, the other piece of it is that I think between the subgroups that we suggest are out there in the megachurch world, there isn't a lot of sharing across those groups. They're distinctive enough that the congregations that are pastor-centered are really pastor-centered, and they don't interact with very many others. Those that are new wave, they do associate with each other, but they don't with some of the other groups. And so that's part of the problem that makes it difficult to survey these congregations. Who do you go to as representative voices that give you credibility within a subgroup of megachurches? And so it makes it a little bit harder. It's like segmented in some ways. I know there were some other parts of that, but I think probably the time is up. Thank you all for coming. They were great questions.
I invite you to come forward get some signatures of Scott's book, and we are appreciative of his time and his research and his hard work.